Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Aaron Powell.
And I'm Trevor Burrus.
Our guest today is Andy Craig. He's staff writer at the Cato Institute and a frequent contributor to libertarianism.org. Today we're talking about a fascinating essay he recently published with us on the causes and dangers of minority rule. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Hey, good to be with you.
Can you give us a sense of how bad partisan polarization has gotten?
Sure. There's a lot of different ways of measuring it. One that you see a lot is, because it's easy to quantify, is in Congress. You'll see a chart that shows how often they vote with each other and how much crossover there is in the middle on votes. And that's famously hollowed out. But I think more than that, there's just a broad sense of how deeply embedded it's become culturally. That it didn't used to be as all-consuming as it is now, and that it's become kind of more central to people's identities in a way that it didn't used to be, and that, you know, religion and what region you live in and all those sorts of things have been subsumed into, red-blue tribalism.
It seems sometimes that there's like two types of takes on this and then a gamut between, because we all talk about this a lot, especially over the last decade, 5 years. Some people want to say this isn't as bad as it's ever been, or it's been worse pre-Civil War. There's been a lot of discord in American politics at different times, obviously Civil War being the worst, but even the years after that, there's pretty discordant even in the first decade of the country of how much the Federalists and Anti-Federalists hated each other. So are you more on the side that this is just sort of a pattern of America, including the urban versus rural aspect of that? Or you think that this is going in a different and worse direction?
I think it's not worse today, but it's different today in ways that obviously it's true. We were a more divided nation when we were shooting at each other on the field of Gettysburg. But what has happened is that it used to be there was a kind of, it was more, there was a mixture and a diversity in American politics from, different regional angles, different religious groups. And so these things formed themselves into two big camps, which usually, though not entirely, aligned with the two major parties. And that would often become very heated and contentious. But it wasn't this total sorting into basically two very homogenous kinds of identities, where rural Republican and urban Democrat is the same thing wherever you go in the country. They vote the same, they care about the same things, they consume the same media. And that is new and different. And that came about partly kind of from the age of mass communications, which had a tendency to nationalize debates. And you saw it first with radio and then television, and now kind of on steroids with the internet. I think it's certainly important to keep the perspective that we are not on the verge of the Civil War. We are not seeing the kind of large-scale political violence that we have seen in this country at sometimes in the past. And so you don't want to get too apocalyptic about equating it to those things. But there is the dynamics that are fueling it, and the kind of runaway spiral escalation of it are things that are new and different and have to be grappled with and addressed in different ways than how we handled some of those past divisions.
What are some of the reasons that typically get given for this newest wave of increasing polarization? In your essay, you mention a handful that all sound rather grim. I mean, political sectarianism doesn't sound super scary, but two-party doom loop and partisan death spiral, those sound bad.
I mean, there's a lot of theories. One that you see that I find unconvincing, and I think most of us at Cato would not be convinced by, is that it's campaign finance. It's money in politics. That's one that you see that I don't think is terribly convincing, because it doesn't make much sense why money in politics would drive polarization. I get why it should drive corruption, is the theory. but it doesn't make much sense that it would drive polarization. One thing you see asserted, particularly on the left among Democrats, is that it's voter suppression, that, you know, Republicans are making it harder to vote, et cetera. And I touch in the piece on some of the reasons why that's going on. But at the same time, when you look at the actual marginal effect of tinkering with voter ID laws and early voting and that sort of thing, it does not make a huge difference. The other really common one you see, and as I just mentioned, I think it has something more to do with it, is change in communications technology, the rise of the internet and social media, which has allowed kind of a, there's no more gatekeepers. It's kind of a disintermediated blob that does not have the hierarchy that it used to have. And so that, in particular, is one of the things that has subsumed regional differences, which used to be kind of the big check on this. America's always had a two-party system, but the reason it used to be very loose, big coalition, big the two major parties, they were united around little more than supporting the same presidential candidate. And you had liberal Northeastern Republicans and conservative Southern Democrats, and some of the most liberal senators were elected from places like Idaho and South Dakota. And, you know, Reagan was governor of California. And because of the way the density divide has played out and the parties have realigned so almost entirely around rural versus urban, with suburban somewhere in the middle, that's something that it just becomes all consuming because it applies everywhere. And so I think that's part of what is happening. But, I mean, yeah, there's no shortage of, like, you know, people say, well, it's war and foreign policy that is, you know, any issue you could name that somebody cares about, there's somebody out there arguing that because we're getting that issue wrong, that's what's tearing us apart. And I think you really have to zoom out a little bit further than that. You can't harp in on any one policy area and really see the big picture of what's driving this.
Your essay, I mean, it talks about polarization, but the thesis of your essay is a little bit different of like how this is working today. And the title is Minority Rule is a Threat to Liberty. So what do you mean by minority rule in this context?
In American politics, we have a rather unusual situation compared to what we would think of as the other major liberal democracies, Western Europe, East Asia, places like that. In that most, not all, but most of our high offices are elected under an electoral system that is not a 50-50 tipping point between the two major parties. Because of geography and the way the rules of our elections play out, you see this most famously in the Electoral College, and that's the one that gets a lot of attention, where in 2000 and 2016, you saw a Republican who, you know, lost the national popular vote, won the Electoral College. And there's a systematic skew there that, depending on how you calculate it, it runs something like 46 to 47% Republican to 54% Democratic is where the actual tipping point of flipping an election outcome is at. But it's not just the Electoral College. Obviously, the Senate, kind of by deliberate design, is not democratically representative because there are more smaller, wider, more conservative Republican states. They get more senators, and so you see a similar thing there. But even in the places that are supposed to be Democratic popular representative branches, the House of Representatives and the state legislatures, you get a very the numbers are actually very similar. In some cases, they're worse. There's states right now where the Republicans can lose the cumulative vote for state legislature by it's pushing 10 points and still hold more seats. And because of that, it, you know, our electoral system is it produces an equilibrium. And that equilibrium is where kind of all the rest of the relative size of the two parties and so much of how they think about political dynamics and cultural dynamics. And so you end up with a system where the Republicans and the Democrats both still end up in power about half the time, because that's where the equilibrium balances. But you have a smaller Republican side of the a smaller Republican coalition and a larger Democratic coalition, and that fuels all kinds of weird illiberal thought processes on both sides. When we're constantly facing this reality that it doesn't feel like a fair contest, and one side feels like they need these rules in order to preserve themselves, and the other side say, "Hey, this is unfair. We got more votes. We didn't win," and so it just has a lot of downstream consequences. The fact that our electoral system has that skewed tipping point.
How much of this is a temporary thing, though, in the sense that Democrats are concentrating among the cities, and the cities' populations are growing. People are at a steady clip leaving small town America and moving to the cities because they are dynamic and economically they're the engines of the country, and that's where the jobs are and that's where the culture is happening and so on. Younger people tend to skew Democratic, and they're the ones who are more likely to be kind of moving to these places. And so it does seem like no matter what structural advantages the rural party might have, there's got to be a floor, right? Like, they're not going to win with 30% of the vote. And so is this something where we're going through a period where they seem the rural party, which is in this case the GOP, seems to have a structural advantage, but another 5-10 years of both demographic change and shifting population, geographically, is going to just mean it's going to kind of moot that advantage?
Well, that's one of the things. Both Republicans and Democrats kind of fear or celebrate that possibility that, and it's true, we are still urbanizing. People are moving out of rural areas into the cities. But part of the point of this piece is that you will still always have the relatively more rural 47%. Now, where that dividing line is might shift. It might, shift from, towns of 50,000 to towns of 100,000, as these things move. But you will still, I don't think it's just a passing thing, and it could actually make it worse, because one of the things that can happen is that you end up with a larger urban population that is then even more underrepresented, because you get, every 10 years redistricting comes and there will be a reallocation of seats and things will shift and partisan coalitions will shift. But part of the reason the system of single member districts that we use for Congress and most state legislatures produces this is because Democrats are inefficiently distributed for such a system. They are packed and cracked, which is what they call it in redistricting circles. And that's something you do deliberately for gerrymandering, but it's also just inherent. And the way that works is that, you have these 90% blue districts that are urban areas that are just deep, deep, deep blue with very few Republicans in them. And you have these more relatively more rural districts that are that still have a third to a quarter of voters are Democrats. It's still a minority. They're still safe red seats, but there's more Democrats in those districts than there are vice versa. And so because of that inefficient distribution, you end up with this system where you get more Republican legislators out of fewer Republican votes. And I think it's potential that the accelerating urbanization could just make that worse. And it could also, it also fuels the insecurity on the Republican side, the feeling that we couldn't win elections, that we couldn't wield political power except for this counter-majoritarian system. And that, you know, we're going to be overwhelmed by the masses in the cities. And that's a large part of what fuels the insecurity, which fuels a kind of, we've got to use it while we've got it attitude towards political power.
So as I alluded to before, I've said at different times that if I were just a pure academic, some historian at some university, I would spend a decade writing a history of the United States as a history of urban versus rural conflicts. It was true at the time of the Constitutional Convention that most, they were deeply skeptical of the East Coast elites. And of course, their East Coast was the difference between like Amherst and Boston. So it's been a long time issue, and they knew about it at the framing of the Constitution. And one of the reasons, although the Electoral College is strange and they actually didn't think about it as much as maybe they should have, but there was a thought that it would help give that and the Senate, when you combine it with the Senate, would help give more representational voice to the rural areas, which have concerns that are not just like the same as population. I mean, like large areas of farmland that are the breadbasket of America have concerns that are not just about population. So, I mean, do we really want to go out to the Electoral College if it's doing this job to some extent of making sure that presidential candidates don't go to Iowa and, you know, always make that stop in Iowa and endorse, you know, corn? But we want, you know, the concerns of Iowans and the concerns of people who live in LA. But if, how much time would a presidential candidate spend in LA if we didn't have LA, New York, and the big cities, if we didn't have the Electoral College?
Well, that's certainly one of the common defenses of the Electoral College. And one of the points I make in this piece is that, for one thing, the Electoral College isn't going anywhere. So if we're looking at feasible reforms, I don't see much there. But one of the key things to understand is that it's not just the Electoral College. It is also the House. It's also the state legislatures. And so it may well be reasonable and desirable to have a degree of counterweight there in that system, to wait a little bit for some offices in some ways towards that side of the aisle. But when it becomes everything, then you're not getting the, you know, the Madisonian intent of the House within that scheme, which is supposed to be the popular representative branch based on pure population, because that does still matter and has to be one of the inputs in the system. So, you know, when we think about the frame, as you alluded to, how much they really considered the Electoral College, there's a lot of post hoc rationalization of the Electoral College that was not really anything they consciously intended. And so, you know, when we look at what the framers did, they did very, very well with what they knew at the time, and developing a kind of proto-public choice incentive-based structure, what we think of Madisonian checks and balances. But there's things they didn't foresee. They did not well understand the nature of parties. They thought they were going to somehow get rid of parties, which we now know is neither possible nor desirable, that any functioning democratic system is going to have political parties. And so you have to harness and you know, build around that. And the other thing, and our colleague Gene Healy has written a lot about this, is the presidency has just become so all-consuming. The entire political system, our parties, everything revolves around the presidency. And so, you know, something that would matter less if we had a more constrained presidency, if Congress was taking more of the lead, you know, as was intended, then the fact that the Electoral College has this little skew in it might not matter as much. It would not be as contentious. It wouldn't be the thing that drives where political coalitions form to the degree that it does. And so that's when I'm looking at reform, I really think the place to start is from the bottom up. The Electoral College is not going anywhere. The Senate is certainly not going anywhere. Even the system we use for the House is pretty deeply entrenched. It's theoretically changeable in some ways without a constitutional amendment. But I think it really has to go to the state level and kind of boil up from below. And that's why I think there's a lot of good stuff happening with possible electoral reforms, more proportional, more multi-party systems, things that allow geographic minorities to still be represented, which is a thing our system really lacks. If you are a Republican in the city, or if you are a Democrat out in the farmland, you basically don't get any elected representatives in high office. The one thing and the one interesting exception from a lot of these trends is actually state governors. And you see that in how state governors are less polarized. You see more cross-ticket voting for governors. You see more moderate governors. You see more governors who win, you know, Democrats in red states and vice versa. So I think that's, but if you're talking about, you know, legislators, which I think is where the primary emphasis on representation is supposed to be, there's a lot lacking there.
Something that occurred to me as we've been having this conversation, especially this last bit of it, is as libertarians, we are fans of methodological individualism, treating individuals as opposed to collectives. But so much of this very conversation and these arguments feel like they assume a high degree of collectivism, that there is something like unique about a person from Iowa, and a person from Iowa, by nature of being from Iowa, is like fundamentally different from a person from Massachusetts. And we need to make sure that Iowa, which is defined as within this border, has its interests represented, as opposed to the individuals who may have, you know, not all Iowans agree and not all Republican Iowans agree on a whole range of things. Or when we're talking about, you know, that the Republican in the deep blue district not having his interests, that's just kind of the nature of elections. Is like, if you lose, you don't get your candidate. And it seems odd to tie that to, we need to make sure that like these collectives called the parties are represented equally or have some degree of like proportional representation, or that different geographical areas, because really it feels like this should be about individuals, and individuals are trying to advance their interests, trying to get what they want, and tying it all into this geography seems to confuse things. And it's part of it is tied into like why I've always found a little bit baffling when libertarians defend, say, the like that we need to give extra weight to the people in like rural states so that their interests are represented, because that kind of assumes that there's something in this collective called this state, whereas maybe I'm wrong, but like the best protection against the interests for like of these smaller states is federalism. It's that you can elect whoever you want to the federal government, but then they can't, you know, they can't interfere in, they're limited in how they can interfere in the affairs of the given states. And then the states can be these engines of democracy or whatever. And so it just, this whole conversation seems to be assuming collectivism when what we should be assuming is individualism. Does that make any sense at all?
Sure. And one of the things about the American electoral system that is different from a lot of other places is our emphasis on geography. Your House district is geographically defined. Obviously, your state is geographically defined. And that's not necessarily the most natural grouping of common interests that people have. But because we only allow elections to be conducted through these geographic electoral units, it forces more emphasis on geography than might otherwise be the case. So if you look at, for example, proportional representation, one of the things you get there is that you can have a geographic minority and still be represented, which is something different from kind of winner-take-all elections. And so you can get it produced not just more moderation, but it kind of more of a sense of buy-in and having a seat at the table, which matters if you're trying to defend a constitutional system from, you know, collapse from lack of public support and the worst things that could come from that. But it's, you know, speaking about libertarians in particular, I think there are very strong reasons to be skeptical of the premise that more heavy weighting of rural votes produces smaller government. It's rural voters who want farm subsidies, rural voters who, tend to be more supportive of military spending. It's rural voters who are more socially conservative, typically, and want to do things like ban gay marriage or more supportive of drug prohibition. And even if you just look narrowly at spending, I don't think there's a very strong case that we as libertarians should prefer, because it produces better policy outcomes, a system that just straight up weights, you know, white conservative rural voters more. And that is something that is hard to justify as a normative matter. And so one of the things the system forces, setting libertarians aside, it forces Republicans and conservatives to do is to come up with rationalizations for why this minority is more entitled to govern. And that can lead to some very dark places. Once you're getting into the business of the populist poison of these are the true people, this is the real America. But it drives people down that path, because otherwise, how do you justify this sort of system? I agree. There's definitely libertarians should be a little bit more skeptical about the idea that these things produce more libertarian outcomes. And you're absolutely right about federalism is the more important, you know, subsidiarity, local self-rule, local autonomy. That protects, rural minorities, rural political minorities much more effectively than just, you know, weighting their votes in favor of determining control of a very centralized national system.
Aside from the way that libertarians should look at who is voting and what they're voting for, I mean, if you're a good libertarian, you should be allergic to the partisanism that dominates the conversation. You might have a lot of other biases in your head, but like, hopefully you're not subject to those partisan ones. And a lot of things libertarians say sometimes is, oh, gridlock, you know, gridlock is good. We don't want either party to be dominating. So in a general sense, why should libertarians actually care that much about this minority rule thing you're describing?
I think it's worth caring about because it produces some very toxic outcomes that can undermine a lot of things libertarians do care about. You know, we care about individual rights. We care about limited government. We care about the Constitution. We care about having good political incentives that don't undermine liberty, that reinforce liberty instead of undermining it. And so, you know, when you have this sort of hyper-polarization, it becomes such a toxic, all-consuming thing that you don't get broad buy-in to, not necessarily, you know, radical libertarianism. We're pretty content with the fact that that's a small minority view, but what we might call liberalism more broadly, or liberal constitutionalism, liberal democracy, and that when you have on the one hand a party that thinks that has to justify why it should rule without a democratic mandate, and on the other hand you have a party that says the Constitution is awful and rigged against us, you can very quickly end up in a place where neither support it, and all constraint goes out the window. The most extreme example I've been coming back to a lot historically is actually Spain. So in the latter half of the 19th century, early 20th century, Spain had this thing called Turnismo, which was basically there was an official liberal party and an official conservative party. And through informal mechanisms and frankly, rigging elections sometimes, but basically they had a power sharing agreement where they would alternate back and forth. And this seemed to work fine until it kind of spiraled out of control. And, you know, you had the breakdown of liberal democratic norms. Things escalated through a few military coups. And by the 1930s, you had fascists and communists slaughtering each other. And that's, you know, that's a place certainly no American or no libertarian would want America to go. So I think that's why polarization matters and is a concern to liberty, and to the degree to which minority rule fuels that and accelerates trends towards authoritarianism. I think that's a libertarian concern.
I agree that the concern here, you mentioned the Spanish system, you know, what there's an underlying concern for the functioning of any liberal democracy is this, the viewing the other side as illegitimate and also electoral victories as illegitimate, which has been ramping up from both sides for quite a while. I felt like that was a lot of what the campaign finance discussions post Citizens United were kind of verging on, that because they were saying, well, you know, the Democrats were saying, well, the Republicans only win because of Citizens United. And now you have Republicans saying that these electoral fraud, and it all can get pretty scary, I think, quicker than most people think can happen. But do you think that that sense of illegitimacy, that the other side's victory was illegitimate, is sort of endogenous to this minority rule thing, that it like came out of it, or it preceded it? It preceded the population shifts that had happened.
I think it pretty well directly does come from, because you have not, you have seen, and there are other broader reasons fueling this, kind of the rise of populism. You've seen the rise of far left and far right parties in other major democracies. But you have not seen that degree of illegitimization of the other side and of election outcomes. If you look at British politics, which might be the one most Americans are to the degree Americans know about foreign politics at all, the one they're kind of more familiar with, you don't see this kind of just screaming rage that the other side didn't really win. We saw on January 6th, libertarians are rightly skeptical of, majority rule sanctifies everything. All we need is more democracy and 50% plus one rule. But at the same time, we need to understand the ways in which electoral democracy channel conflicts that otherwise could and would play out violently, much more violently than, you know, the violence inherent in the system. And it's fragile. January 6th really did underscore. If Trump had not backed down the way that he did after, you know, he kind of got scared into it and sort of backed down after January 6th. If he had urged on, I think we very easily could have seen large scale political violence in the United States. And that's something we've gotten maybe a bit too comfortable in assuming isn't a possibility, and that our system is so stable, our constitution is so secure, it couldn't happen here. But when you see a breakdown of electoral democracy, it goes there very quickly. When people feel that elections are stolen, they will get violent about it.
How much of this stolen election narrative is the result of the geographic sorting that we're seeing and the media landscape sorting that we're seeing, so that you can have someone who lives in a place where we all live in or around Washington, D.C., and the district has, I think, Biden won in the 90s, Like it is, you could live in DC and never meet a Republican, you know, and never talk with one. And so you get like everybody is supporting Biden, or you can live in these rural small towns and everybody, and that we have, I mean, it's kind of insane that we sort geographically and politically, and that political opinions map to like where you happen to live on this plot of dirt. It's like conceptually doesn't make a lot of sense, but that you just kind of, it's easy to talk yourself into thinking there was fraud because you don't know anyone who voted for the other guy, and you can turn on the TV and hear all these people telling you this. And so is this something where this is happening because of these structural things in the way our political system is arranged, our electoral system, or is it just that we've kind of sorted ourselves and now we are closed off to anyone who thinks different from us, and so we kind of assume that our side is maybe bigger or more powerful than it actually is?
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. I mean, even going back to the 70s, there was a famous quip by, I forget what his name was. He wrote for like the New Yorker or the Atlantic or something like that. And he said, how could Nixon have won? I don't know anybody who voted for him. And that's absolutely the case. And it goes, you know, in both directions. You're right about DC, but it's absolutely the case. If you live in rural small town Arkansas, like where I came from, you might occasionally encounter a Democratic voter, but even they will be conservative Democrats. And so it is very easy to become immersed in this narrative where you look around and everybody you know in your whole world is on one side of this political divide. So how could it have legitimately played out any differently? When you see the numbers come in, and it turns out you actually did lose. And I think part of that is that we also have the paucity of voices that, you know, we don't have the rural liberals and the urban conservatives like we used to, not just in elected office, but in the political media, in culture. It has become so strongly sorted that you don't see the kind of the countervailing, the opposite bucking the trend sort of voices. And those can be key to bridging that gap. And, you know, it's not, I mean, this is, and you see, I think there's actually a demand for this. So one of the things you see is that coastal liberals love to latch on to any time they can find a rural conservative, particularly religious figure or clergyman who will side with them on immigration or abortion or whatever the issue is. And on the flip side, Republicans, you know, I mean, look who their last president was. He was not from rural Iowa. He was the class traitor who, you know, was the billionaire from Queens. But who turned on the elites. Or if you look at Tucker Carlson, who is, you know, a silver spooned kind of New York elite media figure, or J.D. Vance, who worked for Peter Thiel and all these sorts of things. People like to latch on to that as a kind of, you know, own the other side thing. But partly it's because I think people realize it's oddly underrepresented, and it upsets this sort of dichotomy narrative. And I think it would be healthier if we had more of that. And if we had a system that encouraged that sort of diversity and mixing a little bit more.
In terms of addressing like possible solutions, especially when it comes to electoral laws themselves, anything that would influence a electorate, everything. I mean, we've been fighting these fights I've been involved with many of them at the Supreme Court for a decade, and even moving a polling station can cause people just lose their minds because it's now five blocks further. And so maybe that will affect Democrat votes more than Republican votes or something. Obviously things like voter ID and gerrymandering makes people go crazy. But they're going crazy in a very their what they perceive as their immediate short-term interest for the next election. I feel like that's usually the biggest concern that they have. And this makes it all very difficult. And it makes me honestly pretty pessimistic, because it's very hard to write the rules of the game while the game is being played. You can do something before the game starts and say, do we all agree that they should be voter ID, in almost like a Rawlsian original position? Neither party knows who this will affect negatively or positively, but do we generally agree on this rule? I see that to be very difficult to do, and just increasingly difficult to change any electoral law. So it makes me pessimistic. I don't know where you comment on that.
No, it's certainly the case that it is very difficult to find things that can get cross-party support. And you know, I mean, even relatively little things, you know, like I said, tinkering with early voting hours or voter ID rules and that sort of thing, that wouldn't even touch most of the stuff I'm talking about here. But you're right, it just drives people crazy. And certainly there's a big role here for the classic libertarian critique, which is that if government wasn't doing so much, we could fight about it less. And that is, you know, certainly a big important part of it. And also decentralizing so that it's not all at the national level. I do think there are some good prospects for reform that are starting to bubble up. One of them is ranked choice voting, which is probably the one that has gotten the most traction. It was adopted in Maine, and it was adopted in Alaska in a slightly different version, and it's been adopted at the local level in a bunch of places.
For listeners who don't know what that is, could you just quickly sketch how that works?
Sure. Ranked choice voting is also known as instant runoff. It's when instead of picking one candidate on your ballot and the one with the most votes just wins, you rank them. And then it goes through this process where the lowest performing candidates are eliminated. Their votes are reallocated according to their voters', you know, second preference. And so what you end up with is a system where nobody gets elected until they clear the majority threshold through this process, as opposed to what you have now, where you have a three-way race. Somebody can win with, you know, 40%, 38%, something like that. And so one of the things it encourages less negative campaigning, because you have to appeal to be the second choice or the third choice, or, you know, as the case may be, of the other candidates in the race. It's a little bit, not radically, but it's a little bit more conducive to having multi-party participation, more than two parties participating in an election. It gets rid of the spoiler effect. And so to narrow in just on case one particular example of how this passed or how it was adopted, in Maine, they had a governor, Paul LePage, who was elected, I think it was under 40% at least one of the times, but twice in a row he was elected on very, very short of a majority. And it was because there was an independent or a green, a left-leaning third-party candidate who did very well and was a spoiler. And so then they did, it went back and forth through the legislature and the courts and stuff a lot of times, but ultimately what cemented it was being able to do it through the initiative process. And that's something in the states that have it. I think that's where a lot of the prospects for adopting various reforms is going to be through the initiative process, because that by design lets you bypass the incumbent legislators. And there's a lot of things that are popular, but are not in the interest of the majority party in a given state. So I think that's the case with a lot of electoral reform. One of the other ideas is nonpartisan elections, which is overwhelmingly popular. If you ask people about it, they love the idea of nonpartisan elections. But only one state right now, Nebraska, for historical reasons, currently has a nonpartisan state legislature. So that's the kind of thing that could be adopted. You could have potentially a state decide to use a more proportional representation system, which is where, you know, you vote for a party list and the seats get allocated according to the total number of votes that each won, which is a very common and popular system overseas, but is been pretty foreign to American politics. So that's a potential something that could be done at the state level, potentially bypassing incumbent office holders. So I think, you know, one of the things I mentioned in the article, there's a lot of pros and cons to these different reform possibilities. And even all the way up to there's the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact that some are trying to push through for the Electoral College, which I'm pretty iffy on constitutionally and merits wise. But I think it's important that there just needs to be experimentation. There needs to be, American states have a lot of structural constitutional autonomy to decide how they run their own elections, including their elections for federal office, but particularly for all their state offices. And to a large degree, it's kind of been a blind carbon copy of the federal system but it doesn't have to be. So I think we're starting to see the prospects for state level reform and experimentation come through, and that if there is a way out, if there's a reason to not be so pessimistic, I think that's where it's going to come from.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy Free Thoughts, make sure to rate and review us in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. Free Thoughts is produced by Landry Ayers. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.